Hello, this is the Conversations Politics podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Education Minister Simon Birmingham inherited one of the 2014 budget's dramatic failures, reform of the higher education system. Deregulation of university fees could not be got through the Senate, and now Senator Birmingham is seeking to craft a new model. He joins us today. Simon Birmingham, the obvious first question is, where are you up to with this task of recalibrating the education package, and what's at least your aspirational timetable?
Well, in relation to university reform, we've made very clear that universities and students can have certainty for the 2016 calendar year, and that any reforms we pursue are ones that won't commence until 2017. I've now met with quite a number of vice-chancellors, with other stakeholders and important contributors to the debate, as well as, of course, having some informal conversations with the Senate crossbenchers about what they may or may not be open to. My ambition is to legislate what we can in the life of this Parliament, but ultimately the government will, of course, have to consider, if we cannot do that, taking some policies and reforms to the next election and trying our luck, hopefully in the following parliament. But I'm still hopeful that we might be in a position to settle on some important reforms that can ensure excellence in our universities and equity of access for Australian students, and to get those done and dusted before we get to the election. So that's a pretty tight timetable now that obviously would indicate the need to start progressing things a little more openly in a more detailed manner next year. But for now, it's still a case of very much listening and getting other people's ideas and talking about the merits and problems with different scenarios.
Have you any idea yet when you might unveil something?
No, there's not a fixed time frame for that. But clearly, over the next couple of months, I'd be hoping to, I guess, bring my thinking to a conclusion. But then, of course, there's some discussions to be had with the Cabinet and to see whether the government is as one on a pathway forward, whether that is the current proposed reforms, some variation on them, or an entirely different looking proposal.
In your discussions with vice-chancellors, how have you found their mood? Because they've been on a rather long and bumpy journey on this whole issue, and they were almost all in favour of the Pine proposal, of course. What's their feeling now?
Well, vice-chancellors are, of course, my new best friends, I find. But Christopher did an exceptional job that is not well enough recognised and credited in having 40 out of the nation's 41 vice-chancellors supporting reform. And they're not always an easy group to get into alignment and to support a policy. So it is a testament to his work at that level, even if, sadly, he couldn't get 6 out of the 8 crossbenchers. I think the vice-chancellors have been very welcoming to me to date, very open to having discussions, and all of them open to talking about alternatives. They seem to be, I would say, quite realistic in what their expectations are of the government. I've been pleased by the fact that they recognise that the budgetary constraints the government faces, and pleased that they recognise the legislative challenges the government faces. So I think we can have a very constructive discussion with the VCs and the universities. Whether they'll all be as happy with where I end up at as they seem to be with Christopher's remains to be seen.
Do you think that fee deregulation is effectively dead, however?
Look, some form of fee flexibility, I think, is still a real possibility, and it's important to think about why we would want to have these types of reforms. I've been very conscious in my consultations to date and speeches that I do want to start out by having discussions about the problems and the challenges and the opportunities our universities face, because policy reform is about dealing with those problems and maximising the advantage from any opportunities. And I think current incentive settings tend to drive too many of our universities to a very homogenous type offering to their students. So we offer funding of identical means that's uncapped in terms of the number of places. That means every university pretty much has the same incentive, which is to get more bums on seats, more enrolments into their classes, possibly offer all the same types of courses and not necessarily think about what their specialisation is, what their excellence is, how they can innovate in their student offering and the like. So I think in that space, contemplating fee flexibility as a way to drive differentiation between universities, greater excellence, greater innovation from them are the reasons to look at it. And I think when you start to talk about those reasons, people start to understand why you might contemplate some model of fee flexibility.
Well, flexibility implies conditions. Would they relate to the quality of teaching, to graduate outcomes? What sort of issues would be involved?
So there are a range of different options that people have floated. Some would see some type of sliding scale of Commonwealth contribution depending upon where universities go with fees. Others indeed look at whether you would only move to certain universities, certain courses, opt-in models or the like. And beyond that, then there are of course the type of conditions you might place on moving in terms of fee flexibility, the transparency around how funding is spent, potential limits on the price that could be offered, or limits on the volume of or value of the loan that that could be provided. They're all ideas that are under consideration, and I guess consistent with the government's overall approach to policy reform at present, I'm trying to be very clear about not ruling things in or out, but actually sensibly considering. That's right, it is, and it's. I think it's one that's been warmly welcomed by the public, that we're actually willing to have sensible policy discussions. Of course, in coming months, as I've said, we'll have to reach some clear landing points as to exactly what is in and out, and then we'll have proper discussions with people to make sure that is right and that we get all the detail of those models correct.
Australian universities do continue to rise in world rankings, and this week another list of universities under the age of 50 was released, and 17 Australian universities feature in the top 100, indeed 8 in the top 50. Given the number of new universities that have been established around the world, this does seem a pretty good achievement. So the question arises, why the urgency for reform?
I think the reasons to consider reform are a few. Firstly, there are financial sustainability pressures on the Commonwealth that the demand-driven system has applied. We've seen enormous expansion of Commonwealth funding into university places over recent years. And there are financial pressures on our very generous student loan scheme that we need to have a look at and make sure that it is sustainable into the future, because the HECS or HELP type student loan scheme is one of the best policy accomplishments of governments in recent decades. Of course, it was a Hawke government initiative, but it stood the test of time, been built upon by the Howard government, and I think is of course something that we should be very proud of. But it is only sustainable if people, of course, go on to repay the loans during their working lives. And that's why expanding repayment to people overseas and making sure that we're getting the bulk of that money back is very important for future generations to enjoy the same opportunity. But I think a really big issue for reform is acknowledging the type of change that universities face. The advent of MOOCs, of open online courses, the advent for global universities of being able to run their courses anywhere in the world through new technology means that our universities are going to face increased competition from overseas, but also, of course, face increased or have greater opportunity to offer more places to more students around the world without necessarily having those students physically in Australia themselves. So we need to make sure that they are innovating, that they are offering the best possible courses in their fields, because otherwise the threat is not just that they might lose some of their international student share, but that in the future we could start to see more domestic students choosing other institutions around the world as well.
Just taking up this point of international student revenue, it's now one of our top exports. What's the government doing to safeguard this industry, which will be so important in the future?
The international education sector is hugely valuable. It's around $18 billion of annual income for Australia now, and our third largest export and earner of course the largest country services and the largest services export. And it's a credit to our universities in particular, as well as vocational providers and schools and English language providers, that so many international students regard Australia as a destination of choice in terms of studying here and learning through our institutions. We have, as a government, made some changes through visa arrangements and are applying a new streamlined, simplified visa arrangement from next year that will help to make it easier for creditable universities and institutions to bring students to Australia. We are in the final stages of developing a new international education strategy, which is being finalised by our new international education minister, Richard Colbeck, and I think that is, of course, a clear sign of the significance that Malcolm Turnbull has put on the international education sector by having a minister in the government who has dedicated attention there and who straddles my portfolio of education and Andrew Robb's portfolio of trade and is really able then to make sure that we are taking a holistic approach in government to maximising our potential in that space.
Could you foresee a time when some institutions, some universities have more foreign students than Australian ones?
I think that is quite possible and nothing that Australians should fear either, as long as we are maintaining the quality of our institutions. And of course, universities earn significant revenue from their international students. It is in their interest to maintain the high quality and high standards. And from that revenue they earn, they are of course then supporting often domestic students or research opportunities. And it's really important that our universities in particular, but also schools and vet providers in the international space are getting the revenue and the benefits of international students and Australian students benefiting from the cultural experience of studying and working alongside those international students. But given the generosity of our support for students and the uncapped nature of domestic places, I think it's always important to emphasise that international students never come at the expense of domestic students. They are in a complement and an additional element that our universities have seized.
A report from the Grattan Institute this week found that universities earn up to $3.2 billion a year more from students than they spend on teaching. What would you like to do to increase transparency about how student fees and government funding are spent?
So I think for domestic students, and importantly drawing the distinction there, because offering educational services to international students is of course a commercial activity in some ways for institutions. But for domestic students, where government funding and subsidies are provided and government subsidised student loans are supporting them, it is important that there's a degree of transparency about where those funds are spent. That's not to say they need always be completely invested in the student's own learning experience. There are benefits to students from universities being strong research institutions. There are benefits to students because that enhances the reputation of the university, which enhances the value of the degree that a student takes away because of the strong reputation of that university. It also, of course, in many instances is the case that research and teaching fellows and academics at universities are integrated and cross over at various points. So it's not as simple as saying teaching funding should only be spent on teaching, and it won't be as simple as saying that you can always differentiate exactly where the dollars have gone. But I do think that students and people making decisions about accessing higher education deserve transparency from universities and the opportunity to be able to look at the value proposition they are getting and to ensure that that value proposition matches the potential employment outcomes and income earning potential of whatever it is they're studying.
Childcare is also in your bailiwick, and you flagged this week that the government would like to abolish the daily fees for children's childcare to allow parents to pay by the hour. Do you have any data as to how this would affect the cost over time?
So, Michelle, I think very important at the outset in this space that I don't really envisage payments by the hour, but I am encouraging childcare providers to think about whether they can offer shorter sessions that enable parents who may have a government subsidised entitlement of 12 hours a day, 12 hours per week of care, to be able to spread that across 2 days and to give a young child 2 6-hour sessions of early learning experience and opportunities through their session, rather than having a 12-hour entitlement paid for in 1 day, when we all know that a 3-year-old is not going to be doing 12 hours of learning in a single day. So I'm urging those providers to think about their commercial business models and to adapt potentially to the flexibility that the government is providing in our childcare reforms. We're putting more than $3 billion extra into childcare over the next 4 years. We're giving greater subsidy to working parents to make sure that they can juggle their competing demands. But for childcare providers, we're lifting conditions about the hours per day they must be open and the days per week they must be open. The only remaining condition around opening times is they must operate 48 weeks per year. But beyond that, they can choose to specialise as an early learning centre that on 3 days a week offers 6-hour sessions of learning potential, as an example. That's really a decision for those operators, but the government is hoping that we can have a more responsive childcare sector because of the increased funding we're providing and the reduced regulation we've put in place.
And this would save people, consumers, money?
Well, this would be ensuring that families were paying for childcare more at the time of use, and taxpayer subsidies better reflected the hours of use of that. But they are matters that are up to childcare businesses to determine how they operate. I don't want any suggestion that that centres who are specialising in providing long day care for working parents who need to drop off early in the morning and need to pick up in the evening would in any way have to vary their 10, 11 or 12 hour sessions. It's just encouraging the providers to say, well, we've put greater flexibility in the system. Please think about changing your business model to suit parents who have different needs.
And what's the feedback been?
Some of the providers seem quite open to it. Others perhaps have a little bit of a cultural change to undergo yet in thinking about whether they could be more creative in their business models.
Now, just turning to schools, which of course was a big issue in the 2013 election, when Malcolm Turnbull became leader, there was speculation that the Gonski plan might be revived with improved funding in the out years. What's the government's current thinking about the long-term funding of schools?
So school funding is locked in up until the end of 2017, and locked in with the very generous payments that we're delivering under the so-called Gonski plan, with the extra $1.2 billion that Christopher Pyne tipped in at the start of our term in government to make sure that those states who hadn't signed up to the Gonski plan weren't disadvantaged through the implementation. So we have record funding going into schools and record growth year on year that's occurring through these years up until the 2018 school year. Over the next year or so, I would anticipate having discussions with the states about how we address school funding from 2018 onwards and how we make sure that it's done in a budgetary, sustainable manner whilst ensuring that it's needs-based. A lot of compromises were made by the previous Labor government when they implemented David Gonski's plans, and a lot of compromises from the model that he had proposed. And I've sat down with David Gonski to talk about his model, and we certainly want to make sure that whatever funding model applies from 2018 onwards, it is needs-based. It does provide the support required to students with a disability, to students from Indigenous or disadvantaged backgrounds, to those who really need the extra support. But it's got to be budgetary sustainable as well, and that, of course, is the battle that I'll be having in working out how we can achieve that. And it's a discussion that I have to work through with the states and the sectors. And to date, I've met with a couple of the education ministers, and I'm sure there'll be more of that once Parliament rises and I get the chance to get a bit more around the country.
An area that's been much in the news recently, and not in a good way, is vocational training. As each day goes by, we hear new revelations of private vocational providers reaping large profits inflated by publicly funded loan schemes. How long can this go on for?
The vet fee help scheme that was opened up by the previous Labor government is a disaster and is one of the worst get-rich schemes that I've seen operating since the Pink Bats scheme that they also ran. We've implemented a range of reforms, some of which don't take effect until the 1st of January next year due to the technical difficulties of changing funding models in the middle of an academic year for vocational institutions. But you know, those reforms are significant. The way the program was structured initially meant that providers were basically incentivized to enroll somebody and they were paid the complete fee by the government on enrollment. Just madness, because then of course there's no incentive to actually provide the learning, training and progress somebody through the course. Our reforms will provide for four separate payments to be made over the course of a diploma, meaning that that then there is an incentive to actually progress a student through the course, or otherwise you don't get the money. We've tightened eligibility around the providers who can be in the system, their experience that's required, and the funding that they need to bring to the table to be a training provider as well. But it's a salient lesson that if you get this wrong, it can go horribly, horribly wrong, and we've seen terribly vulnerable people targeted by some of these vocational education providers. Thankfully, the ACCC and ASQA, the industry regulator, have now really come to the party during the course of this year and taken steps to deregister providers, to launch legal proceedings against some of those who've engaged in misleading practices, and it's very important that our regulatory standards are of the highest order. And our funding programs, when they're set up like this, are established in a way where they cannot be rorted and where quality learning and training outcomes are the priority, not just enrolling people for the sake of ticking boxes.
Do you think it's appropriate that we pay for some of these courses at all? Beauticians, for example, vital as they are, those sorts of courses? Is this...
My view is that employment outcomes should drive the decisions there. And so as long as there are jobs for beauticians, then I've got no problem with the government subsidising and supporting training for beauticians, because what we want are to help people engaging in training to get jobs, get better jobs, progress their careers and opportunities through life, and to be good citizens who pay their taxes and help fund all of the services we want to offer.
But pay back these loans.
And hopefully pay back these loans as well, because they get jobs out of the training they've done. But I think it is a fair question about whether we are training too many people in some of the wrong areas. And so we will be thinking over time, in addition to the reforms we've already announced, about how it is that we might structure the system in a better way to make sure that it is training people genuinely in areas of need. And of course, another part of that is also the same transparency argument we were talking about with universities as well, making sure that there's good, robust, reliable data associated with individual institutions about whether their students are completing, and if they are completing, whether their students are getting a job and how good that job may be in terms of income potential and so on, so that students themselves can make rational decisions before they sign on to some of these things.
Let's just finish on a couple of general questions. You're a prominent moderate, and suddenly in the Turnbull era, the sun is shining more brightly for the moderates. But at the same time, the Liberal Party does seem to be more sharply factionalised these days, with the Conservatives speaking out on issues, especially security issues. Do you think this factionalisation is creating a problem?
I have been very pleasantly surprised in some ways by how smoothly the transition to Malcolm has gone, and by the extent of general harmony and support that exists across the parliamentary party and the party more generally. Of course, you know, we have always as a party been the broad church, as John Howard always called it, and I can remember as a young party member during the early days of the Howard government, the fact that John Howard would come to Liberal Party conferences and he would, in speech after speech at Liberal Party conferences, celebrate the fact that we are a broad church and celebrate the fact that we are the custodians of a liberal tradition and a Burkean conservative tradition. And I think that is one of the great strengths of the party. And I hope and trust that Malcolm will celebrate it just as John Howard did. And that means you've got to encourage the fact that there will be differences of opinion within the party from time to time. The only challenge then for a governing party is how you appropriately reconcile those differences of opinion. And I think strong cabinet government that Malcolm is trying to lead, where you air all of those differences around a cabinet table, you air them in the party room processes, and then you reach a consensus is the best way to do it. Worked for John Howard. I'm hoping it can work for us again.
Just finally, a parochial point. Both you and your ministerial predecessor, Christopher Pyne, are South Australians, where the government's fortunes looked very, very bleak under Tony Abbott. Have they significantly improved? Has the mood changed under Malcolm Turnbull? Are you more confident that in South Australia the Liberals will do well next year?
I think Malcolm's optimism for the nation has been quite infectious, and that infectiousness applies in South Australia as much as anywhere else.
So they believe it's the best time to be alive.
Great time to be a South Australian. Look, South Australia has challenges, and South Australia is at the perhaps the forefront for Australia of the type of disruption and transformation in the economy that Malcolm has been talking about and wants to tackle quite directly. The loss of old manufacturing jobs and the decline in some of those sectors obviously is hitting SA harder than the rest of the nation, with the highest unemployment in the nation. So South Australia needs to be at the forefront of looking for ways to invest in new industries. And I'm confident that what's coming up in the innovation statement, the investment in naval shipbuilding and ultimately decisions around submarines, will provide the opportunities for new businesses and new industries in more technologically sophisticated areas to hopefully start up and provide new opportunities in SA.
Some in Birmingham will be back to talk to you next year when you land that higher education package. Thank you very much. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins, and we'll be back with another interview soon. That's all from the Conversations Politics podcast.